Welcome to the Free Will Show, a podcast that provides a beginner-friendly introduction to free will while also exploring cutting-edge developments on the topic. I'm Taylor Sear.
And I'm Matt Flummer. In this episode, we talk with Janann Ismail about how our ordinary conception of ourselves as agents who make free decisions is not in conflict with the classical deterministic model of physics. We also discuss how to think about determinism in light of recent advances in physics.
Thanks for listening. I'm happy to introduce Janann Ismail, a professor of philosophy at Columbia University and affiliate of the Zuckerman Institute. Her areas of specialization are the philosophy of physics, metaphysics, philosophy of science, and the philosophy of mind. And some of her work has focused on physics and free will in particular, which is the topic of this episode, especially her book called How Physics Makes Us Free, which was published in 2016 by Oxford University Press. So welcome to the show, Janann. And could you start by telling us and our audience a little bit about yourself, your work, and how you came to be interested in working on these issues related to free will?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here. So I started out as a philosopher of physics, which means, you know, you're focused on kind of foundational problems in physics. Some philosophers of physics are doing more kind of general philosophy of science work. And I think the reason I got interested in free will is, I mean, there's a lot of contingent reasons, but in physics, you sort of learn that you should always look where the really hard problems are. That is, the ones where you know that something can't be right, where things aren't lining up properly. Because mm-hmm. That's where one is bound to find new insights and potentially disruptive innovations. In physics, I think that leads people to focus on kind of the frontiers of knowledge. So, you know, sort of the physics of the very small, where there are things that we don't understand, or the very large scale universe. But for philosophical questions, I think there are places where the scientific worldview doesn't make sense, that are much closer to the level of the human being. I started out thinking for a while about time and things like consciousness, and free will was a very natural step where, you know, you're experienced of yourself as an agent in the world seems to clash quite spectacularly with what physics is telling us, or what one is told that physics is telling us about what the world is really like.
Yeah, very interesting. As Taylor mentioned, you have a book called How Physics Makes Us Free. We make it a habit of asking all of our guests to define expressions like free or free will. So could you tell us what you take being free to mean?
Good. So this is a non-standard answer. I don't really have a dog in that fight. And in a way, it gives me an advantage because my approach is much closer to the person on the street who doesn't have any philosophical commitments about what free will is. So I tend to think there's freedom with a small f and there's freedom with a big F. The person on the street just acts. So the woman on the bus, she makes decisions, she frets over them, she tosses and turns, mm-hmm. you know, when she has a difficult choice to make. She takes responsibility for her actions. She knows what it's like to make a choice, knows what it's like to act, and knows the difference between things that she does and things that happens, that just sort of happen to her. And by knows here, I mean that in a kind of pre-articulate way, a non-theoretical way. So people like that, when they're presented with an image of what physics tells us the world is like, you know, that old Laplacian image mm-hmm. where there's somebody who's some kind of super intelligence who's told the positions and the momentum of all the particles that make up the universe. A person like that, or an intelligence like that, is then also given the physical laws. And the claim is that the physical laws, if they're deterministic, allow a being like that to predict everything that will happen in the whole course of the world, including what you will do, you know, at every moment in your life, the thoughts and the decisions that you'll make. Now, a person on the street presented with an image like that feels shocked and feels insulted and feels like there's some sort of clash between what they believed or what they thought that they believed about, or what they thought that they knew about themselves, before they had even really formed any articulate view of what it means to act, and so on. They feel shocked, insulted, and that's what I took the conflict to be. So when I talk about freedom, I mean freedom with a small f, in the sense of whatever sort of control we have over our voluntary actions that distinguishes them from reflexive and automatic processes, what makes us whatever it is that makes us toss and turn when we have a difficult decision to make, makes us think and use expressions like "it's up to me" and "it happens in the here and the now" and "what I'm doing now is going to make a difference to what happens in the future." That's what I mean when I talk about freedom. So this is something that we all share,
yeah.
You know, this sense of whatever that pre-articulate notion of freedom is. But then there's freedom with a big F, and that's a name for some explicit philosophical analysis. I actually doubt that there's a shared concept that every man on the street has. And if one looks at, you know, the philosophical literature and what freedom with a big F is supposed to be, you won't find agreement there.
Right.
So I think, you know, one person says, freedom with a big F is autonomy. Another person says it's self-determination. Another person says it's the ability to do otherwise in some technical sense. So I think, you know, whenever someone's offered, like the person on the street, that, and certainly this is the way I felt. I mean, I started to look into this partly because I felt that pre-theoretical clash. when you're feeling that clash, and you're presented with some philosophical analysis that's supposed to show you that, and freedom is understood this way, you see that it's perfectly compatible with this deterministic image of the world. I think they tend to feel that it's false consciousness, a con, not what they meant. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, what that suggested was that the problem is really the negative picture. So freedom is defined negatively by it being something that doesn't seem to fit into this Laplacian image. And that if one can really come to understand the negative picture, then one will have a better grip on the concept, the shared concept, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting and helpful to kind of see where you're coming from. I wonder, a lot of the people that we've talked to and a lot of people who work on free will try to get a handle on what the average person means by free will by connecting it to moral responsibility and being genuinely accountable for what we do. Do you have any thoughts on that and like whether this idea of something's being up to me is connected with the idea of responsibility?
Clearly that seems so. And I think one of the ways, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. One of the ways of getting a purchase on the idea of free will is precisely by connecting it to moral responsibility and then effectively, implicitly defining it as whatever would have to be the case in order for us to be morally responsible. And then look at the kind of scientific worldview and see whether there's something there that supports moral responsibility. Mm-hmm. I think, I think for me, partly because I'm not a moral psychologist, I'm not a moral philosopher, I was really I take physics seriously enough to think that it's true. I mean, I take it seriously enough to think that if physics tells us that the standard for a physical theory being correct is that it's true, and it seems to me that if you take that image seriously, then you really do have a problem just reconciling it with your experience of the world. So what I wanted to do was just to genuinely understand, whether physics was something, the physical image of the world was something that I could believe was literally true given my experience in the world. So I think that's where I was coming from. I wanted to understand the sense in which there seemed to be a clash there, what the clash amounted to, and whether at the end of the day I could end up believing what the physics was saying there.
Yeah. Nice. Well, so maybe we could ask now, what is it about physics or maybe a deterministic understanding of physics that seems to clash with our conception of ourselves as free in the sense that you described?
So what one hears, I mean, this is the kind of, when I think the philosophical literature and the way that the problem is motivated in the popular kind of literature as well, you don't hear much about physics. You're told that physics is deterministic, and this is what, so you get about two lines, and you're told this is what determinism entails. Determinism entails that the world started, or, you know, I don't even have to literally say the world started, but at some early time, the initial state of the world at that time, together with the laws of nature, logically entail everything that will happen over the complete history of the world. Mm-hmm. That's often sort of animated by this image that I mentioned earlier, this sort of Laplacian image of, yeah, you know, a superintelligent being that knows the positions of the momenta of all the particles that make up the world and knows the physical laws and can predict everything that will happen, including everything you'll do and so on.
Yeah.
I think one way to think of that, to get rid of the kind of metaphor, is to think, I think there are two very basic commitments that most people have. Very basic commitments. They're absolutely kind of foundational to the common sense picture of the world. One is that the past is fixed. Mm-hmm. Right? And the other one is that things don't happen that the laws of nature don't allow.
Right.
So what determinism seems to do is it takes those two very basic commitments and it tells you that if you believe that the past is fixed, it allows you to leverage that into the fixity of the future.
Yeah.
And that's where I think that you get the clash with the person tossing and turning over the course of the night, making a difficult decision. That seems to only make sense if you think that the future in some sense hinges on what you're doing in the here and now. So you have a very different, the embedded point of view for the agent making a decision imposes a very strong asymmetry in, your attitude towards the past and future. And what determinism seems to do is to tell you you can't have a different attitude because the future is entailed by the past.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it seems like the conflict, see if you would put it this way, is with the picture of determinism that you painted, where the future is just as fixed as the past, and our experience of ourselves as agents in the world, and the way that we, like, it doesn't make sense to deliberate if you don't believe that the future is open.
Right. So the natural embedded attitude of the person making a decision demands of an asymmetric attitude towards the past and the future. And one way to see that, even before you offer some philosophical analysis of what that is if you tell a person that the future is fixed, they don't know how to deliberate about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Perhaps the person on the street thinks that there's a kind of bypassing at play. And the future, when you tell them the future is fixed, they think, oh, well, then it doesn't matter what I do. But the physics doesn't tell us anything about that, because the future that is set might depend on what we do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are various, so that's, I think that's the right intuition. There are various ways of trying to spell it out. So one weak way of trying to spell it out that has been discussed in the philosophical literature is that, well, look, if the future is counterfactually dependent on your decision, that's completely compatible with determinism, and that's all that's required. I think that wouldn't be enough to satisfy most people. And the way that I like to think about that is think about something like a toaster. So what comes out of the toaster is counterfactually dependent on the wires and all of the happenings inside the toaster. But what comes out of the toaster is also fixed as a matter of hardwiring inside the toaster by kind of, what happens to the lever on the outside. And I think, part of what's going on in the concern about determinism is it's not just that you think that the future depends on what you do, it's that you think your own actions aren't determined by things that are outside of you. So one way to put that is you think that your decisions play a pivotal role, that you could fix the outside, and there still are physically possible futures depending on what you decide. And that's a way of making precise the sense in which the future hinges on what you decide. It's not just what happens outside of you. You're not just a part of the causal landscape that the world passes through on getting to the future. It's that somehow what's going on in you is going to make the difference between it going one way and another, even when the physical laws and the past are fixed. So that's that phenomenology of tossing and turning over the course of the night. I think it's precisely because of that. You're looking into the future, you're seeing different futures, and you're thinking that which way it goes hinges on what I'm doing in the here and now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is a natural segue. We're talking a lot about our view of people or as a self. And you talk about the pre-theoretical view of the self and how you think it might need to be replaced with something more nuanced.
Right. So, you know, part of the project for me is to start with a naturalistic picture of the world and genuinely understand whether I can make sense of myself as just a natural thing in the natural world, as it's described by physics. Because again, I mean, I should emphasize, it's not quite again. I mean, it connects to what we said earlier that, you know, for me, it's not so much that I take it for granted that physics is true. And so we have to accommodate our conception of ourselves to physics. It's rather that if physics can't make sense of our own experience, that suggests that something is wrong with the physics. Mm. So the project for me was kind of defeasibly start with a physics picture and really try to imagine yourself into a picture like that. What would we have to be for physics to be true? And what does it tell us, you know, about the role of ourselves and our actions in the kind of unfolding of the history of the universe? What do we look like through physical lenses? And try to see whether that could make sense. So I think pre-theoretically, you know, we think of ourselves as indivisible loci of mental life, distinct from brain and body, that sort of enter into the causal order from outside. When we're representing the world, we mostly don't represent ourselves. Maybe we represent our bodies because that's something that we see and something that we take care to kind of manage in ways because we're seeing, you know, we do see, but mostly we're representing the world, the environment, and the things in our environment. And when we're making a decision, we treat ourselves as, you know, things that are intervening on the environment from outside of it. Mm-hmm. And that's partly why, you know, we think of ourselves in this way as indivisible loci of mental life distinct from brain and body and as entering into the causal order from outside. But physics has if we're looking at in a modern worldview, it's literally material bodies themselves are understood as clusters of events. At the bottom, I'm going to ignore quantum mechanics and just speak about classical physics because that's where the kind of one gets the sharpest and the clearest conflict between physics and the human being. Because it looks like the classical worldview is deterministic. It's also true that I think just in physical terms, we're too big and too warm and too slow for quantum mechanics to lightly make a difference. But in any case, let's address the problem in the classical setting. Might turn out to be that quantum mechanics is relevant, but we get a sharp understanding of the problem by looking at the classical picture. And also that would help us see how quantum mechanics could potentially make a difference if we understand what the problem looks like in a classical setting. So assume a classical setting, relativistic setting, at bottom the world is just, the universe is a manifold of events. A manifold is just a particular kind of mathematical description of a structure. manifold in question has three spatial dimensions and one temporal dimension. Human beings are just minded bodies. Bodies are just certain kinds of dense collections of physical events that are laid along the temporal dimension. Okay. Only reason for saying that much technical stuff is there's nothing that looks in there like an invisible locus of mental life distinct from brain and body. So one has to, you know, sort of understand both why we think we tend to think of ourselves that way, but what we actually look like, what is there in the world that, you know, corresponds to, in physical terms, corresponds to minded bodies. And so that's what I try to do in the first part of the book. I say, if we take physics seriously, bodies are these clusters of events. Minded bodies are bodies that are, you know, that have brains in them, and the brains support mental lives, and the mental lives, you know, sort of the mental lives represent the world as it's seen from a first person perspective. And the self in that picture is just the proper subject. I mean, there's a lot more to be said here, but the self in that picture is just the proper subject of self-ascribed mental attitude. So when you say, you know, I believe such and such, I'm going to do such and such, the I there is just the proper subject of those kinds of thoughts. So if you can understand in physical terms how there could come to be bodies, how could there could come to be brains, and the role that brains play in moving bodies around space in such a way that it supports the kind of mental life, the kind of psychological life that underwrites first-person attitudes, then for my purposes, that's all you need to understand the self. So then the role comes to be, what role does the conscious mental life of an embedded, human being, so a minded body, what role does it play in history as represented through the lenses of physics?
Nice. Let's turn now, if it's all right with you, to the threat to free will from determinism. And you already alluded to this kind of argument earlier. This idea that if determinism is true, and if the past is outside of our control and the laws constrain what can happen, then it looks like the future is in some sense set. We certainly don't have the freedom to do otherwise, so it seems. So this is going back to Peter Van Inwagen's consequence argument, which we had an episode on season one of the podcast. Do you want to say a little bit more than that about the argument? I was hoping that you could say a little bit about how you think that sort of threat to freedom from determinism should be addressed.
Good. Okay. So I did something in the book that I'm going to add a little bit to now. So what I did in the book was I said, well, let's take seriously this requirement that our thoughts, and in particular our decisions, should be able to play a pivotal role in determining which way the future goes. And the way of sharpening up what that would amount to is to say, determinism is to ask this, are there solutions? And I mean, I wanted to put this in sort of concrete detail in such a way that it could actually turn into simply a question about what physics entails. So assume a classical world, assume the Newtonian laws of motion. And what we're asking is a straightforward physics question. Is it possible for the decision, which is a mental event inside the brain of an embedded human being, once we fix the past, are there multiple solutions of the Newtonian equations of motions compatible with that past that have different futures depending on what goes on in the mind of an embedded human being? So that's a way of formalizing what pivotal control would amount to. And the answer is straightforwardly yes. And the reason is, so there are a number of reasons. But I'm going to give you the simple to understand reason, and then I'm going to give you something more that has come in my mind to be increasingly important and increasingly illuminating. But the simple reason is that, you know, when you look in physical terms at what's going on. It's not that the world outside the human being by itself determines what the future is. The human being has to be in there as part of what, as part of the causal basis that determines the future. If I take the negative image of the world, meaning I take all of the matter in the world, but I take your body out, or I just put a blank spot in there, so I don't describe what's going on in your body, and I ask, are there multiple solutions to the equations of motion that are compatible with everything that's happening outside your body, in which the future depends, and depends in more or less common sense way, or the way that common sense thinks, on what's happening inside your body? The answer is, of course, there's multiple solutions. It matters in direct, it matters obviously indirectly in a way that physics agrees with what's going on in your mind. Whether you raise your hand most of the time depends on what you're thinking and what you decide, and that's represented by the state of your brain over the course of time when you're making a choice. So that simple synchronic question, can we fix the past without the human being in it and show that there are multiple solutions to the equations of motion that go one way or another depending on what's going on in the person's mind? The answer is yes, of course. What's going on in their mind in that sense plays pivotal control. Exercises a pivotal control about what happens in the future. Mm-hmm. The thing that the defender of the consequence argument is then going to say is, yes, but what happens in your mind, the state of your body before you're making the choice and over the course of that time, itself depends on its past. Right. So I think the way to understand it is that physics does say, modulo a correction I'm going to make in a minute. But this is the way that I presented it in the book. Physics does say every human action, the way in which the past determines the future, every human action is a confrontation of different kinds of lines of development. Synchronically, it's a confrontation between a human being with, their physical state and the state of their brain, and an environment. And the environment and the human being together determine what the future is going to be like. So you can't take the human being in. And it's also true that the human being is a product of their own past. So a decision is a human being confronting an unknown environment or a quickly changing environment and responding to that environment in a way that's determined by their own past. And in a way that directly implicates all of the things that one thinks that one's voluntary choices do. So here's what your development looks like over the course of your life. You're dropped into the world with a certain kind of physical structure that's given to you. It's partly embodied in your genes, partly embodied in the kind of the structure of the human brain and so on. And then over the course of your life, lots of things happen to you. You're educated. There are lots of accidents or circumstances, and your early life, most of the stuff that happens to you and that determines how you begin to develop is not stuff you make choices about. People feed you things and they teach you things and you absorb it all. But increasingly over the course of your life, you have a hand in both the kind of experiences that nourish your mental life and where your body goes and who you choose as friends and so on. That process I call a process of self-constitution. So the things that determine at the beginning, of a deliberative episode later in your life, what you're going to be bringing to bear in determining how you're going to respond to a presented situation is stuff that I think of as stuff that you have a hand in creating. And I don't know why anyone would feel that somehow that stuff is determined by your own past, that somehow means that they don't have control or that they've ceded control. To me, in my mind, that's you coming into being and coming into being in a way that you have a direct hand in steering. You know, so when you make a decision and you're told that, yes, you know, when I make a decision, it's all of that stuff that I've cultivated over the course of my life and extracted from the kind of accidents of my upbringing and experience, I bring that to bear in making a decision. So my hopes and my dreams and so on. To me, that answers perfectly well to the common sense idea of what it would mean for me to make a difference to what happens. Mm-hmm. So the thing that I now think that I want to add to that, that seems to me important from a physics point of view, is I can see how someone can still say, you can say all of that, but it's all a subterfuge, because the way that you would develop over the course of time was laid down at the very beginning of time, the second that right. God down the positions and the momenta of all the particles. So it might be that you're the process of you becoming is something that took a long time and that you think, right? But still, that there was no necessity, there was no contingency from the very, you know, like literally in physical terms, very shortly after the Big Bang 14 billion years ago. So it may feel like there's a lot of contingency to you, but there was no contingency. Actually, that's not true from a physics perspective. And this is where, you know, this is not something I talked about a lot in my book. It's come to seem to me increasingly important to get rid of this image of the universe that, you know, people will, even when from an embedded point of view, they can start to feel the persuasiveness of what I just said, you know, right. embedded point of view, there's a tendency to then try to step back and look down at the universe as a whole from a transcendent perspective and think that you can see your whole development and process of coming into being as just the inevitable playing out of initial conditions of the universe. So I think one has to get rid of that so that one doesn't feel that it, but what's interesting is that physics is actually does not support the idea that there is this transcendent perspective, and in particular, the view of time and the evolution of the universe, that perspective demands, is one that physics has overcome or moved beyond. Mm-hmm. So this is where, you know, one has to adopt and take very seriously the view of time that comes from relativity. When you combine time, when you combine that view of time with determinism, it is no longer literally true that the set of events that counts as the past for you before you make a decision or at any moment in your life physically determines, as a matter of law, anything that happens in your future at even a finite fraction of a second from now.
So I'm probably confused because I don't have as much knowledge of physics, of course, but I guess it sounds to me like what you're saying is once we understand relativity and the updates in physics, it's going to turn out that determinism as we had initially defined it, that's actually false. But the way you put it was, oh no, actually once you combine determinism with relativity, it's false that we lack freedom in this ordinary sense. So I was wondering if you could say maybe a bit more about how you're seeing determinism as being reconciled with relativity.
Okay, good. So I didn't actually define determinism in any way. I'm assuming two things. I'm assuming first that the threat is supposed to come from physics, right? So we want to understand determinism in the sense in which it's present, in which it's given to us by classical physics. Right? So classical physics does entail that if you take, now I'm going to speak pre-relativistically,
okay.
But if you take the total state of the world at some early time, it will determine the total state of the world at some later time. Now, of course, Newton himself believed in a view of time that said that time is an external parameter in which the state of the universe, in which the universe unfolds. So the universe itself was something like a very big material object,
right?
Like a very big rock, you know, constituted by three spatial dimensions. So it was extended in space. And it evolved in time. Relativity tells us that's not what the universe looks like. And I should say one more thing. In a Newtonian setting, too, Newton himself formulated the laws in such a way that what happens at a particular point in space depends on the global state of the world. Because if you remember your Newtonian physics, you'll remember that the way that a particular localized particle moves depends on the forces, the total force acting on it. And the law of gravity says that every particle, no matter where it's located, exerts a gravitational force on every other. So to know how this particle moves, you would have to know where each particle in the universe was located and how many particles there were. So relativity is a huge advance in a lot of ways, both in what it tells us about the physical laws and in the way that it changes our conception of time. So the way what most people know in philosophy who sort of work on time and things, they'll know one thing, that relativity changed. It tells us that the universe isn't a three-dimensional object that evolves in time. It's the four-dimensional manifold that I mentioned earlier. It's a kind of four-dimensional network of events. And the events are related to one another by spatiotemporal relations. And it no longer makes sense to talk simply about the spatial relations between any two events or the temporal relation between them, because the world just doesn't divide up in such a way that allows you to talk. I mean, the way that I like to think about it is I'll finish my thought. I always do this. I'll finish the sentence and then I'll add to it. But so that you can't talk about there being at some particular temporal interval between any two arbitrary events. Right? You can't talk about which events happen now. You can't talk about which events about any. You can't take any two events and say whether they happen at the same time or how much, how much time has passed between them. Mm-hmm. Instead, you have to talk about spatio-temporal relationships. Those are the basic relationships. And that means that at any point in space, the world divides into three sets of categories. There are those events that lie in the future, those events that lie in the absolute past. And then there's this sort of big gray area of events that happen neither before nor after, and that's called the absolute elsewhere. And that's the kind of structure. Events aren't ordered in this tight way that we can say whether they're past, present, or future, but we can say whether they fall in the absolute past, the absolute future, or in this sort of big gray area of events that's neither past nor future. That's the relativistic sort of version of now, if you like, or simultaneous. It's this sort of this gray area, neither past nor future. If we consider just the absolute past, and we say, does the absolute past of you at this moment determine an event that falls a finite fraction of a second into the absolute future, assuming the classical laws of motion? I forgot to say the other important thing. So let me back up for a second. So that's the way that relativity changes our conception of time. It also shows us how to reformulate the laws so that we no longer need to refer to global state of the universe at any time. The laws are reformulated in such a way that what happens at a point in space depends immediately only on the matter in its immediate environment. So it reformulates the physical laws, including everything that Newtonian mechanics entailed, in this local form so that you can calculate what happens to a particular particle immediately as a function of its immediate environment. Now you put those two things together and you say, does relativity entail that what happens at some finite interval in the absolute future, is that determined by the absolute past? And the answer is just straightforwardly, no, never. Even though the laws are deterministic in the sense that they were deterministic in a Newtonian setting. Mm-hmm. Right? So the way in which physics gives us deterministic laws in a classical setting is compatible with the idea that the future is not determined by the past when those are appropriately understood in a relativistic sense.
Interesting. Okay. So the terms of the debate that were set up 50 years ago or whenever Peter Van Inwagen came up with the consequence argument, I can't remember exactly when it was, the definition that he was giving of determinism is this classical sense. And you're saying now that physics tells us that even though that's true in the classical sense, there's a new way of thinking about this where determinism doesn't, or let me say it this way, that picture of determinism is just not accurate to reflect the way the reality is.
It's crucial to hear, to say the picture of determinism that people have. So here, there are several technical things that are true. And then there are pictures that people, philosophical, hermeneutical pictures that people have taken away from them. The letter of what Van Inwagen said is correct, interpreted in one way. The letter of what he said is incorrect, interpreted in another way. And the picture that people need to support the threat to free will, I'm going to suggest, is not correct.
Yeah.
Here's the technical thing that's correct. Now, I should say, most people in the physics community continue when they talk about determinism to do something that's very convenient for the purposes of calculating, which is, you know that strictly speaking, the world does not divide along the lines of the intrinsic geometry into total states that can be compared with one another at different times. But they continue to say, okay, well, let's take this slightly looser network of events and let's just impose a kind of ordering. So we divide it up into what's called the foliation so that even though the universe itself doesn't tell us or its intrinsic geometry doesn't divide events up into past, present, and future in the ways that we like to speak, we're just going to impose like a kind of coordinatization so that we can compare the state along different leaves of this foliation. When you do that, it is true that the events along any leaf of this foliation will, as a matter of physical law, determine the events along other leaves of the foliation. And moreover, because we've gotten accustomed to using these kinds of tools when we're doing physics, it's very common to write down a mathematical object called the Hamiltonian that represents the total state of the universe and that combines with an operator that we tend to think of as encoding what the laws tell us about how it will evolve. So we've got all of these tools that encourage us very strongly to think in pre-relativistic way of the universe as having a global state at a particular time and as evolving in time. Everybody knows that strictly speaking, the metaphysical picture that relativity gives us is not one of a universe whose initial state was completely determined at some moment in time. Everybody knows that strictly speaking, these foliations that we're talking about, that contain the full set of events that's needed as a matter of physical law, to nomologically, that is, as a matter of physical law, determine the future, don't actually fall in the past of any point in space-time. To completely slice the universe across and capture all of the events that you would need in order to nomologically determine the future, part of the events along that complete slice, if you choose any point in space-time, are not going to be in the past of that point. It'll be different events for different points, but for any event in space-time, its past is not going to include one of these complete slices through the universe. And moreover, right, that's not just a weird trick, because if you look at what's happening there, I mean, this is part of the stuff that's not in the book, but has come to seem to me increasingly important. Part of what you realize when you look in detail at any given event and its past and what you need to add to its past to determine its future, so you completely adopt a kind of embedded perspective, what you see is a set of events that's needed to nomologically determine my future from my perspective in the here and now are events that currently lie in the absolute elsewhere. So they're neither before nor after. And the way in which they impact my future when it's something like a voluntary decision is in exactly the way that I said before, that my past meets an unpredictable situation, and together I and these new events determine my future. And moreover, the way in which, when it's a voluntary decision, those events contribute to my future is in a way that's regulated by my decisions about how to bring them to bear. So it's a very common sense picture in some ways. It's very uncommon sense from a metaphysical point of view, because the view of time is very different. But the causal picture that's built in to the relativistic space-time structure is one that I think supports rather than undermines the common sense picture of our place and the role that we play in making the future what it will be.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was all very interesting, fascinating, really. I wanted to go back to something you said earlier about quantum mechanics, because a lot of people, when they hear about contemporary physics and free will, they think, oh, the world's indeterministic. A lot of the physicists who give interpretations of quantum mechanics interpret the laws as indeterministic. But you mentioned earlier that for us, human agents, we're too big and warm and slow for the indeterminacy at the quantum level to apply to us. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that and kind of why it's important to still worry about determinism when we're working on free will.
Good. This is all completely defeasible, because we don't understand enough yet about quantum mechanics to be sure. I mean, physics could lead in a direction, as it often does, that surprises us. But right now, the classical picture of the world is what's called the effective physics at the level that's likely to matter to human agents. Because quantum effects, people do think, as you said, they think, well, if the fundamental physics is indeterministic, then the problem's solved.
Right.
But all that matters is that the physics that applies to us, the physical laws that are derived from the fundamental physics that apply to human action, whether or not they're deterministic. People don't realize, and this is part of what explains why it took us so long to discover quantum mechanics. And moreover, to test various, to test our understanding of quantum mechanics, people don't realize in direct practical terms how really, really hard it is to have quantum effects show up at the classical level. So there's a process that's called decoherence that happens for reasons that we understand increasingly well. That means that whenever you have something that embodies the peculiarities of quantum mechanics in a way that would demonstrate the indeterminism, it very quickly washes out. It very quickly collapses into something that gets rid of the specifically quantum features of behavior. You have to have something, incredibly well controlled mm-hmm. for quantum effects to be observable and to be amplified to the level at which they're going to make any difference that we could potentially detect.
A common example that I've seen in the free real literature is a Geiger counter. So would that not be a good example?
So what you're detecting with the Geiger counter is what's called the collapse of, I don't want to say things that are going to be quantum mechanically. We observe the classical effects of quantum decoherence. I think the right thing to say is nobody right now understands effectively any mechanism by which a human brain that produces something that manifests as a decision could be a quantum effect. There are proposals for this. So Roger Penrose, famously with Stuart Hameroff here, have some very speculative proposals about how there could be these things called microtubules that collapse wave functions in the brain, and maybe that's what's going on. I myself will be very surprised if it turns out that that's what human decision is. Nor do I see any reason to think that if that's what's going on in our brain, it gives us the kind of control over ourselves that we like to think of when we think of free will. I take it as just a matter of philosophical reflection on what I want when I want free will, that I don't just want my actions to be not determined by things in my past. I want them to be determined by me. And when I say me, I mean the proper subject of my thoughts and hopes and dreams, the things that I've built up over the course of my life and all of that. That's what I want to make a difference to the future, not some quantum effect in my brain that's happening below the level of consciousness. So in my mind, I think as a strategy for trying to defend human free will, which I take to be human control over their own actions, that's a bad strategy. As a matter of physics, I think it's extremely, not just poorly motivated philosophically as a strategy for defending free will, but I think it's extremely speculative. And has very few adherents. Though in physics, you know, one follows the science where it goes. I just will be very surprised to see if that's what turns out to be the basis of human behavior.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Part of that is a little daunting or discouraging because I have a hard enough time keeping up with the literature on my stuff. And I'm like, oh, I got to learn physics too. Right.
Except that, I mean, I think in some ways, so this is why why I became a philosopher of physics is that there's frontier there. You know, physics is genuinely offering us a philosophically new image of the human being and its place in nature at the same time that it's offering a completely new, image of what nature is like. And I find that actually exciting. And it's also one because of the way that it's mathematically expressed, it permits of a level of precision that, you know, sort of philosophical pictures don't often do. So I think the task of, in some ways, trying to articulate philosophically what physics seems to be telling us about ourselves is easier than sitting in the armchair and trying to do it.
So where do you predict there'll be interesting developments, or what areas of science do you think it would be most fruitful for philosophers interested in free will to explore?
Great. I think there's a couple of places. One is something that's just begun to be coming into focus in a way that's clear enough and stable enough for philosophical interpretation is our understanding of the various eras of time. So in physics, this has meant understanding thermodynamics and the sorts of irreversibility that physical processes in our everyday world show and how that's compatible with the time symmetry of the underlying laws. For philosophical purposes, and in particular purposes of understanding human agency, I think we've begun to see how to turn that into an explanation of why we remember the past but not the future, and the sense in which the causal arrow, or at least the arrow of influence running from human decision, runs into the future and not into the past. So that way that I phrased the difficulty in the beginning that determinism seems to present, that the embedded perspective presupposes a very strong agency, strong asymmetry between the effect that we have over the future and the sense in which the past is fixed, but the future isn't. I think we've begun to have the physical things that we need in place to try to address that in physical terms. The other place, I think, is with complexity. So there's just been a huge burgeoning of interest across the sciences in complex systems and the emergence of laws governing potentially complex systems. Human beings are a complex system. Brains are complex systems. The emergence of levels of explanation and levels of organization from underlying physical dynamics is where I think all of the exciting stuff is going to be happening in the future. And the more insights that we can get out of that, the better. Although the focus has been on, trying to derive laws, of course, it's precisely the separation of those levels of description in a way that potentially opens up the space for new forms of freedom from laws that I think is exciting. So I would say to philosophers, those are areas where things will be happening, and I think things that will cast new light on the topics that you've been talking about.
Interesting.
Yeah. I saw on your CV that you have a contract with OUP for a book on time.
Right.
Is that out already, or do you have an idea of when it'll be out?
So it's a book is maybe overstating it. It's one of those very short introductions on time. So it's this Oxford series, a very short introduction. It's meant to give a very compact account of developments in physics with respect to our understanding of time. It actually, all of the things that I just mentioned here about differences between past and future, and the stuff on relativity is in there too, in a very sort of easy to digest form. It's being released in the UK on October 28th, and it's on Amazon, and I think they'll release it here a couple of months later. I don't know what their schedule is.
Okay. So it would be a good place to start.
Yeah, it would. Those topics, definitely.
And on the topics of levels of description, levels of explanation, actually, we're going to talk about that more in our next episode. So that's kind of cool. Well, thanks so much, Janann, for joining us. This has been awesome. Where can listeners who are interested in following your work go to find you and follow what's coming out?
Okay, so now you're embarrassing me because my website is ridiculously out of date. I do have a website, and you're going to shame me into trying to update it. So
there we go.
It's at Janann I.
There's no shame. No shame at all around here.
Well, great. Well, we'll link that in the show notes so that people can just click on it directly. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me and for such great questions.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. This was fascinating. Thanks again. In our next episode, our final episode of this season, we'll continue our discussion of physics and free will. And our guest will be Christian List, professor of philosophy and decision theory at Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich.